Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Any lingering doubts you might have had that this is a global economy should be gone by now. Chinese investors sold off almost 9% of their main stock index today. Even before traders hit the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, you knew which way the arrows were going to go. You just didn't know where things would land before the closing bell rang. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years, with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad you could be here on this Tuesday. Today's the 27th of February. Those gains the markets had been enjoying so far this year, record highs and all the rest, they're gone. All three major indices are now below where they started the year. Not necessarily a bad thing for those who believe a correction's long overdue. Al Goldman's the chief market strategist at A.G. Edwards.
The good news today is that this dramatic sell-off in the market means that the correction is getting its dastardly deed done sooner rather than later.
The sell-off was across the board. Volume was extraordinary. More than 4 billion shares changed hands. All 30 Dow stocks were down on the day. The blue chips were off 546 points for one brief moment, which was our cue to call David Johnson. Never a good thing on a day that's not a Friday. Mr. Johnson, quite an afternoon.
It's, you know, actually a remarkable day. And we knew to be on our toes because you could see this coming. There was that big sell-off in China, and then there was a big sell-off in Europe, and then there was a fairly big sell-off here. We thought we'd kind of dodge the bullet, but boy, that last hour was a killer.
What happened? I mean, you know, I stepped away from my desk, came back, and we were down 300 more points.
Yeah, I know, and it happened to all of us. It literally was that quick. Right at, I guess, 3 o'clock Eastern, 2 o'clock my time, noon your time. There was a drop of over 250 points in the Dow Industrials average. And your knee-jerk is to say, you know, some stupid clerk sold a million shares mm-hmm. and only should have sold 1,000, and the computers did it or whatever. Now what we're understanding is that it may well have been that the Dow, because of a miscalculation, maybe a computer error, software error, was understating the magnitude of the sell-off. For some period of time. And so then it really, instead of down 260, we might have been down 310, and then a little later down 350. But what happened is they switched computers, and it all caught up at once. And, gee, I wish they'd never caught up.
Yeah,
it was
right. Talk to me for a second about fundamentals. You and I have talked for months about how people are looking for reasons to buy out there. They found reasons to sell today. Is there something that's making them think that maybe stuff's not as good as it seems?
Well, there was just a lot of things sort of coming together all at once. We still have those Greenspan words sort of echoing in our ears from now 36 hours ago when he made this speech and mentioned the possibility of a recession. And there's a lot of buzz about subprime lenders and how much money they're losing, and a China contagion that causes sell-offs in Brazil and Russia and India and across the board. But it had been, and you and I talked to this a jillion times here, 2.5 through almost 3 years since we'd had a 2% correction in one day. And you expect a half a dozen of those a year. So here's the one that maybe will last for several months.
Yeah, very quickly now. Are we looking at another week and a half of sort of unsteadiness before this thing settles out?
I really can't look beyond that. I would be amazed if there weren't some sell orders that hit these markets early in the morning. And then let's just kind of see how they handle them. It may well be that the buyers, you know, see that we're having a sale and they come rushing back in again.
All right, we'll see what happens. David Johnson down in Dallas. Thank you, David.
We will survive.
As Johnson said, the news out of China overnight set the tone one day after they drove the Shanghai Composite Index to yet another record high. Investors sliced 8.8% off Chinese stocks. Robert Hormats is vice chairman at Goldman Sachs International. Mr. Hormats, good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you.
What do you think we have here? Is this just a slump? People are tired over there and they were looking for a break, or is it something bigger?
I think the markets went up very, very quickly. They had a great run. And now people are perceiving the fact that perhaps they were overbought. Second, they see that the government of China wants to try to get a little bit of the speculative pressure out of the markets. A lot of people are borrowing from banks to buy stocks. The government wants to stop that or at least slow it down. And the government also wants to cool off the economy a little bit, which is why it's tightened interest rates and tightened up on bank reserves.
How much of this volatility in the stock market do you think is due to relatively inexperienced retail investors over there, seeing the stock market going great guns and piling in and now sort of bailing out?
A lot of it. People do not have a lot of experience with volatility. A lot of people are going into the market for the first time. Many of them feel that they can borrow lots of money from the bank, buy stocks, the stock will go up, then they sell the stock and repay the bank loans. It's a case of, I think, excessive leverage, excessive optimism, and also perhaps a feeling that the Chinese government would let this run for a lot longer. But the Chinese government is concerned about a big asset bubble. They saw what happened in Japan in the 1980s when the bubble burst, and they do not want to see this happen again.
What's your level of discomfort with the possible systemic ramifications of this today? Slower demand in China means slower growth here, which means slower worldwide economic growth?
It will have some negative impact on the U.S., and we'll see it primarily in companies that sell a lot to China. We'll also, I believe, see it in commodity markets because the Chinese are large marginal investors of almost every major commodity. If their economy slows down, that will slow down demand for those things. But I believe that the government of China is going to do everything it can to avoid this decline in the stock market leading to a sharp decline in economic activity.
I was just checking the calendar. Do you think this could be sort of another Black Tuesday that we're going to remember for a while?
I think we will remember it for a while, but China, in its essence, is still a very strong economy. And I think if you look at this as an overdue, perhaps a long overdue market correction, and an opportunity for investors with a middle and long-term perspective to buy, I don't think it will last too long. But I do think a lot of the speculative frenzy, this irrational exuberance that a lot of investors have exhibited, does have to be wrung out of the market. So it's a correction that many markets go through. For the Chinese, it's a bit traumatic because they don't have the record of experience that many of the other large economies do. But this will help their people to become more sophisticated investors and more cautious, although some will certainly lose a lot of money in the process.
Bob Hormats is the vice chairman at Goldman Sachs International. Mr. Hormats, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure. Nice to be with you today.
It only got worse in New York as the day wore on. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Wall Street wasn't the only place where things were a little sour today. Disneyland is suing its hometown of Anaheim, California. The park wants to make sure no new housing goes up within 2 miles of its front door. Pat Loeb reports.
The fairy tale that Disney uses to describe its dispute with the city of Anaheim is the goose that laid the golden egg. Disney spokesman Rob Dowdy says the suit is designed to protect the tourist district that drives Anaheim's economy.
This area, which represents less than 5% of the land of Anaheim, contributes nearly half of the city revenues that pay for city services like fire and police.
Dowdy says that a long-term plan the city developed 12 years ago prohibits new residential development in the area that surrounds the two Disney parks. The Anaheim City Council was considering making an exception. The city is in desperate need of affordable housing. A local developer had proposed a complex that would have included 200 moderately priced units. The project went before the city council 2 weeks ago. Councilwoman Lucille Kring says she was moved by testimony in favor of the project from workers who serve the tourist trade.
We had people come up to the podium who said, we can work here, we're good enough to work here, but we're not good enough to live here. And that's heartbreaking.
Kring had to abstain from voting because she plans to open a business in the tourist district, and the project failed to get enough votes to proceed. However, Dowdy says Disney's suit is necessary to prevent any future attempts to build housing in the tourist district. In Los Angeles, I'm Pat Loeb for Marketplace.
The National Governors Association has been meeting in Washington this week. Amid discussion about the state of the states, there's been some lobbying, too. Governors from 14 states are warning they're about to run out of money for a key children's health insurance program. Caring for the uninsured is only one of the health care problems they're facing. State governments are trying to make sure rural areas are covered, too. Pomeroy, Washington is trying once more to sell small-town life to big-city doctors, as Hannah Jaffe Walt reports.
Dr. Saeed Zafar is from Bangladesh. He wanted American citizenship, and to get it, he had to put in 3 years as a physician in an underserved medical facility. That's code for the inner city or the boonies. Zafar and his wife opted for Pomeroy, Washington, a tiny town of 1,400 on the state's eastern border with Idaho.
We came by one route where we could actually see from the hilltop the size of the town. We thought it's awfully small, so that struck us quite a bit and amazed us.
For the past 7 years, Zafar has been this town's only full-time doctor. But this summer, the Zafars are leaving. They're moving to Atlanta to be closer to extended family and to be in a place where they aren't the only Bangladeshis. Talk to Pomeroy residents, and it's clear. This town is used to having its heart broken by doctors.
I think people are small-town people or they're not, and some of them don't find out they're not until they come here.
Doctors, they come and go like Kleenex. Unfortunately, because we are the end of the world, I'm sure.
Everybody in this town is sick of the Kleenex effect. So this time around, the hospital is devoting $50,000 to recruiting a new physician. And they've brought in the big guns. So where are we going now?
We're going to take a community tour, all four corners of the community.
Kurt Volker is the big gun. He's a national recruiter with Merritt Hawkins and Associates. He says to sell this job, he has to sell Pomeroy. And that's not going to be easy. Rural areas across the U.S. struggle to find family doctors. The money isn't specializing. Plus, the workload in a small town is intense. You have no colleagues, and you have to convince your spouse to move to the sticks. But Volker says there are a lot of positives here. So, you ready for the pitch?
Someone can come in here who's got leadership abilities, who has a love for taking care of a community.
To get doctors, rural communities are getting more and more creative. They're hiring people like Volker, applying for federal grants. They're even offering to pay back medical school loans. But the problem is only expected to get worse. Baby boomers are aging, and fewer Americans are going into medicine. The situation will be especially bad in rural areas. So towns like Pomeroy will likely find themselves battling the Kleenex effect well into the future. In Pomeroy, Washington, I'm Hannah Jaffe Walt for Marketplace.
Coming up, the microeconomy of refugee camps.
At a restaurant in the camp, men sit at plastic tables and watch Al Jazeera News on satellite TV. Across the street, people check their email and play video games online.
But first, let's do the numbers. When all was said and done on Wall Street, the Dow Industrials had hemorrhaged 416 points, about 3.25% to close at 12,216. The Nasdaq shed 96 points, 3.9% to end the day at 2407. The S&P 500 saw its biggest loss in more than 3 years. It bled out 50 points, almost 3.5% to finish at 1399. A lot of Chinese companies list on exchanges over here, and U.S. investors just couldn't get rid of them fast enough today. China Telecom dialed down almost 7%. Fuel giant PetroChina sputtered down 6.2%. China's offshore drilling giant CNOOC sank more than 5.5%. And Baidu, China's answer to Google, clicked down more than 6.25%. Not a good day for companies doing a lot of business with China. Alcoa lost almost 4.5% today. Walmart announced it's taking over a major Chinese retail chain. Timing is everything. Walmart stock fell 3.5% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the preliminary fourth quarter gross domestic product report. The Joint Economic Committee of Congress examines wage and income instability. And NASA's spacecraft, New Horizons, makes its closest pass to Jupiter. It will then be hurled toward Pluto, where it is scheduled to be in 2015. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There might be a glimmer of hope for the troubled Tribune Company. Chicago real estate mogul Sam Zell is said to be interested in buying the publisher of the Chicago Tribune, the LA Times, and nine other newspapers. Tribune owns the Chicago Cubs, too, if you're a baseball fan. The company had put itself up for sale amid falling profits and a nasty fight with some of its shareholders. No word on Zell's possible offer price, but Tribune might be thankful just to get a viable offer. In a PBS Frontline documentary airing tonight, correspondent Lowell Bergman looks at the economics of the news business. And I asked him how the Internet has changed journalism.
The quantity has increased, but not the quality. It's still an open question who produces the best quality information. The difficulty is here that real in-depth news is in danger because the economics for supporting that kind of gathering of news is deteriorating.
There's a disconnect, though, somewhere between people who are looking for the profit and people who are doing the journalism. If you look, and you do in this series, at the Los Angeles Times and newspapers, newspapers typically make as much as 20% profit. Isn't there sort of a greed factor that happens here when that's not enough for some of the people who are investing in these organizations?
Well, let me give you a little history lesson. Newspapers were making 40, 50, and 60% profits 20, 30 years ago. That's one of the reasons when they went public and started selling their shares that Wall Street was so interested in them. Part of what's going on here is a disappointment in the investment community as they see the level of super profits that the newspaper industry once had shrinking so that they're heading to the red. That's part of what's going on here, that Wall Street is disappointed and no longer sees a value in newspapers. The other side of the coin, however, is that newspapers have this unique public interest function. And I think we need to recognize that in and of itself and do something as a society to preserve it.
What about a free market argument? That if the newspapers can't keep up in a cutthroat competitive environment, maybe we just let them wither and something better will come along.
Newspapers haven't been profitable over the last half century in a free market environment. They've been given an antitrust exemption so they could be major metropolitan newspapers with no competitors in most marketplaces. That's a government, if you will, perk. The circumstances around that have changed. Newspapers, by the way, are in the Constitution of the United States, not just as most people think in the First Amendment, but the whole post office, its creation in the Constitution, came because Benjamin Franklin and others wanted to have basically the free distribution of newspapers. So from its origins, newspapers have had various government guarantees because of its public service role.
Well, with the web ascendant and newspapers and arguably broadcast on the decline, what winds up going away as these models change?
Almost everyone agreed that we interviewed on all sides of the question, we're going to lose some newspapers, we're going to lose some news organizations, we're going to lose some in-depth reporting, some investigative reporting. At some point, there will be a bottoming out. Possibly it will become a situation where you have to pay for quality news on the web. That may have significant effects on what kind of free information is available to the great majority of people who don't want to do that or pay for it. So how this all plays out in the end is still an open question.
You and I obviously have personal and professional interests in the strength and character of journalism. How do you make other people care, though?
Well, part of the reason we did this series was to point out what some of the problems have been, both in the issues like confidential sources and national security reporting, and now part of what I would call a perfect storm. This kind of struggle with the U.S. government that's been going on has happened in the past, as it did 35 years ago. The Pentagon Papers, the Brandsburg case, the Watergate situation, all of that together created a situation of conflict with the government of the United States and almost unprecedented in our history. But it came at a time when the broadcast news industry and the newspaper industry were both becoming extremely profitable and powerful, where the economic base was there, where they could resist the government, pay for the lawyers, do the kinds of things that they needed to do to expand their influence and protect their journalists. And that doesn't exist today.
Lowell Bergman is the correspondent for the latest offering from Frontline. It's called News War. Check your local listings, as they say. Mr. Bergman, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for your time.
There's a link to Frontline's new documentary, The News War, on our website. It's marketplace.org. UN's World Food Program says 200,000 Somalis have been cut off from humanitarian relief amid the fighting there. The U.S. has been going after al-Qaeda targets, and rebels have been trying to bring down the new Somali government. Just across the border in Kenya, another 170,000 Somalis live in refugee camps, camps that are supposed to be temporary. But most refugees have lived there for years, waiting for peace back home in Somalia. Inside the camps, people balance dependence on aid with grassroots economic development. Gretchen Wilson reports now from camps in Kenya near the Somali border.
It's only 9 in the morning, but already it's 104 degrees. Inside the Ifo refugee camp, men haul sacks of grain onto their shoulders and carry them to a distribution center surrounded by men and women squatting on the ground. Inside, workers scoop dried corn from large wooden troughs. Twice a month, one person from each family stands in line to collect a few basic foods, such as lentils and cooking oil. Usually, this kind of dependence is all most outsiders ever learn about refugee camps, but it's actually the beginning of a dynamic economy that operates on razor-thin margins. At a restaurant in the camp, men sit at plastic tables and watch Al Jazeera News on satellite TV. Across the street, people check their email and play video games online. Buildings here are made with twigs and plastic bags, and owners operate with the help of generators and cell phones. Ambia Gureyogasa is a single mother of six. Like everyone else here, she's not allowed to leave the camp to work.
There's a ban on our movement. I cannot do business. Our lives are so restricted because I'm 100% dependent on the food aid.
Like most refugees here, Ugasa barters a portion of her family's donated food. She trades dried corn to other refugees for about 10 cents a pound. With that, she'll buy things like pencils so her kids can go to school. Ali Adengabube has lived here for 15 years and buys a little here, a little there. His stockpile of dried corn fills a tin-sided shack. By standards here, he's well off.
I get this by buying food from other refugees. I get small quantities. Some of them sell me a few pounds because they need other things.
He'll resell the corn later for cash. It's pure supply and demand.
I get the highest prices when there's a drought or when heavy rains make the roads impassable and the aid trucks can't get here.
Trading food sometimes means going hungry. There's a 22% malnutrition rate here, which aid workers call worse than an emergency. But a select few have created thriving businesses. Ahmed Kamal crouches on the sand, making doors out of tin cans that once contained cooking oil donated by the U.S. Here, this is high-end construction.
I see the community needs this kind of door, and there's only a few of us making them.
At this internet cafe inside the camp, customers like Ahmed Cody surf the web for 3 cents a minute.
This helps me communicate with my relatives in the U.S. and back in Somalia, and I read about news and sports.
Over the years, the businesses have made the refugee camps the commercial hub for this entire region. These camps are on an illegal trade route from Somalia, where there's no government to tax imports. Goods from Dubai and beyond come into the camps on Somali trucks and usually go out again with Kenyan merchants who come to these markets for the low prices. Shop owner Hussein Mohammed Hira.
Like milky, sugar, rice, everything. There's so many things that we receive from Somalia.
But the whole market system was thrown into disarray in January when Kenya closed its border with Somalia, the source of these cheap goods.
There's nothing coming from Somalia now. The border is closed. Nobody can pass. There's no inlet and outlet.
And that must affect your business?
There's big effect. There's a big effect.
Kenyans even come into the camps with new business ideas. Usia Muhammad, who's not a refugee, moved from 100 miles away to offer international telephone calls by satellite.
We came here for a job. We want to make money here from refugee camps.
Though refugees are still confined to these camps, they're becoming demanding customers. Owners of the internet cafe say clients want a digital camera so they can send pictures back home. Inside the refugee camps in Dadaab, Kenya, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Gretchen took some pictures while she was in Dadaab. They're on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by the Speaking of Faith book tour in Washington, D.C., March 9th. More on when Krista Tippett will be in your city at speakingoffaith.org. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note to update a story we've been covering the past couple of weeks. We've told you about Chrysler's restructuring plan and the 13,000 jobs the company's going to cut. Today, the Detroit News reports Chrysler has offered all of its 49,000 blue-collar workers a buyout to walk away, up to $100,000. They'll also get 6 months' worth of health insurance. Workers closer to retirement age will get a $70,000 early retirement package instead. It's all still less than similar buyout agreements reached at Ford and General Motors. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Rough day on Wall Street today, as we told you earlier. Investors gave back all the year's gains and then some. The Dow dropped 416 points, 3.25%. The NASDAQ down 96 points, 3.8%. The S&P 500 lost 50 points. That's 3.5% there. Thanks today to Miguel Macias and a fond farewell to Brian Watt on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on this program, we'll take you to a metal processing plant in Peru.
On cool mornings, exhaust from the plant sits here like fog, full of sulfuric acid, arsenic, cadmium, and lead. It burns holes in the shack's steel roofs. Studies show that nearly every child under the age of 6 here is technically poisoned.
Our monthly series, Working, continues. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.